Welcome to Sassy Reads for You with Annette Botko, a.k.a. Dolly's Daughter. Sassy takes you surfing through books and her own perspective on reality. A production of Cosmic Reality Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Sassy Reads for You. I'm Sassy, Annette Botko, and I am reading Nancy L. Hopkins' Cosmic Reality. There are two books in this one book, and we are reading the John Kennedy Jesus Christ Connection. This will be aired for the first time on Wednesday, September 9th, 2020. We are on chapter 4, and the section title is Hitler, the Channel. And we're going to jump right in, because that's the way I do things. For those who may be unfamiliar with the term channel, it refers to a person who enters into various degrees of trance, allowing another being a vehicle for communication. This channel essentially receives a telepathic signal, which is allowed to take over and speak through the channel. More and more people have taken up channeling in the 1980s and 90s. There are books written to teach you how to become a channel, but in the early 1900s, there were only a few known channels, and Hitler was by far the most successful. Adolf Hitler was born in an Austro-Bavarian frontier town, already the birthplace of a number of mediums, some well known. People with personal knowledge of Adolf Hitler called him a medium with supernatural powers. One saw a demonic force where the personality of Hitler faded and the body became a temporary vehicle for those other world forces. Another saw Hitler as turning into an archangel with visions of leading mankind to glory. Still another saw Hitler take on a trance quality where the speaker was inhabited by something that seemed to have a fluid quality, a mediumistic trance with an ecstatic expression, was how another explained Hitler when in the role of channel. While we can only surmise what forces were actually using Adolf Hitler, it is quite clear the man had foreseen much of what transpired. His Mein Kampf, M-E-I-N-K-A-M-P-F, foretold all he intended to do and much of what he accomplished. He even claimed Germany would finally be saved, and even that could be construed as being true if one believes in the end Germany was saved from the Nazi evil. It is obvious that to Adolf Hitler and the Thule Society, the concept of not being alone entailed being in contact with powers or entities from a different time, dimension, and/or world. Also very clear is the ultimate Nazi goal is to gain powers beyond those of normal men and to use secret knowledge to evolve into supermen. This search for ancient knowledge and hidden powers are central themes for a number of cultures and secret societies, including Freemasonry. The Forefathers Club. Adolf Hitler grew up in Catholic Austria, where Freemasonry was forbidden, although lodges existed in great secret. Hitler viewed the eagle, as do Masons, as a symbol of the loftiest powers and faculties attainable. Favorite authors read by Hitler included those of Freemasons Fichte, Goethe, and Lessing. Hitler concluded Freemasonry had lost its heart, yet while attacking Masons, Hitler did not attack the basic doctrine underlying Freemasonry, the idea there was some great secret being protected by a select group of individuals. According to Hitler, Freemasonry had largely become a vehicle for its members' mutual benefits and not an organization dedicated to the search for spiritual development. Researching Freemasonry proved difficult, as there are only a limited number of documents on the subject, and because every Mason takes an oath never to disclose the inner workings of the organization under penalty of death. Walter Leslie Wilmhurst's, he was alive from 1867 to 1939. The meaning of Masonry states in the first sentence that his words are solely for members of the order. Wilmhurst claims the need for secrecy lies partially to protect Masons from those who would misunderstand and persecute them and profane the doctrine. Yet the real reason for the secrecy seems tied to the fear individuals who have not experienced the correct internal development could use certain powers for evil purpose. It is the promise of undefined, although apparently psychic powers, which underline the real final goal of a Mason's development. The evolution of Freemasonry appears innocent enough. During the Middle Ages, the prevailing concept was the royal families and nobility had a divine right to rule and demand the best from life at the cost of everyone else. Economic realities resulted in traders, bankers, and infant industrialists evolving into a class powerful enough to compete against the nobility. The expanding middle class consolidated power by organizing craft unions. One of the most powerful of the unions was created by stonemasons, whose union was organized in lodges. By 1717, Freemasonry, as an active organization of practicing craftsmen, had fallen into destitution. In that year, at London's Apple Tree Tavern, certain men organized the Mother Grand Lodge to oversee a revitalized Masonic organization. The innocent craft unions were soon Masonic lodges of, quote, speculative Freemasonry, unquote, which have spread throughout the world in various forms and branches. The Masonic concern for psychic powers and secrecy were shocking enough. Then I began to comprehend the incredible power wielded by Freemasonry on history, particularly in America. Since at least 1733, Masonry has been a major American political force. Virtually every leader of the American Revolution was a Mason. Even the Boston Tea Party was conducted by members of Boston's St. John's Lodge during a break in a Masonic meeting. The Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Great Seal, found on the back of every $1 bill, were Masonically inspired. Even the cornerstone of the United States Capitol building was laid during a full Masonic ceremony. At least 20 U.S. presidents and 16 vice presidents are known to have been Masons. 1970. American Masonic membership exceeds 4 million, and a Grand Lodge has been established in every state. There are two Supreme Councils, a northern and a southern jurisdiction, presiding over the Scottish Rite Masonry, the most popular form of American Masonry. The Scottish Rite originated in 1801 in Charleston, South Carolina, USA, and had phenomenal success in spreading from America into Argentina, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, Egypt, England, and Wales, Greece, Guatemala, Holland, Ireland, Italy, Mexico, Paraguay, Peru, Portugal, Scotland, Serbia, Spain, St. Domingo, Switzerland, Uruguay, and Venezuela. I don't know what was left off there. That was an awful lot of places. Masonry appears to sanction revolutionary response to politics. Not only did Masons spearhead the American Revolution, the architects of the French Revolution were also Masons. In addition, Mason Simon Bolivar led revolutionary forces in Ecuador, Colombia, and Venezuela. In Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Peru, Mason Jose de San Martin fought Spanish forces in battles of independence in the 19th century. Mason Jose Marti was a Cuban revolutionary leader, and there were Masons Jose Rigal in the Philippines, Chile's Bernardo O'Higgins, and Mexico's Benito Juarez. Mumbo Jumbo or Enlightenment. My initial studies made me see Freemasonry as an ominous phenomena, yet I also had to address the fact the most precious documents and institutions in America were the handiwork of Masons. I was confronting the baffling notion the architects of America appeared to be heavily involved in the mumbo-jumbo of psychic sciences and ancient mysteries. Masons individually and as a group, are striving to maintain certain undefined mysteries. An individual joining the Freemasons' ranks is taken through ceremonies and teachings designed to instill knowledge of ancient mysteries. Masonic writer Wilmhurst claims, Freemasonry was created to instruct a secret science by a group remaining, quote, obscure and anonymous, unquote. The secret science provides individuals with principles, through which an understanding of the self can be gained, along with understanding the true relationship with life. Wilmhurst accepts that along with the physical body, each individual has an ethereal counterpart termed the astral body. Within this astral body exists a higher consciousness, which is usually undeveloped and only active during periods of stress or deep emotion. Wilmhurst points out that the three chief qualifications required for an individual to obtain a higher degree of consciousness are that of faith, hope, and unbounded love. Upon gaining an increased level of conscious awareness, the Mason realizes an enhanced understanding. With this new level of comprehension, the Mason obtains an enhanced mental strength, observable as a higher level of character, speech, and overall conduct. An individual is brought to the higher level of consciousness by a systematic series of initiations. Most individuals have limited perspectives because they accept knowledge derived through the fallible senses. Wilmhurst indicates this limitation in perspective keeps the individual from tapping powers of the soul. The goal of Masonry is to assist individuals in penetrating illusion of physical phenomena and awaken powers obtainable only at higher levels of consciousness. Masonry uses symbols, myths, and allegories, which are transposed into spiritual values by the individual himself. This use of symbolism has a tradition in the ancient mysteries, as well as most religions. On the one hand, symbolism is a method of teaching. On the other, it's a way to mask actual doctrine. According to Wilmhurst, the knowledge obtainable is foolishness to the world, running contrary to all considered orthodox. To protect themselves from ridicule, the founders of Freemasonry chose to use symbolic, traditional, historical myths to protect the doctrine, contributing to the overall secret aura surrounding Masonry. The individual entering the ranks of Masons is a candidate who must successfully pass through 3 degrees before being considered a Mason, a Master Mason. These 3 separate ceremonies are called the Craft Degrees and are common to all Masonic groups. First Craft Degree, Entered Apprentice. The first craft degree of the Entered Apprentice focuses on qualifications of the man himself. The candidate must demonstrate discipline over his, quote, grosser nature, its appetites and affections, unquote, which seems to indicate a need for controlling such earthly emotions as greed, arrogance, jealousy, lust, and other physical-rooted tendencies. It requires developing the self-discipline to refrain from looking outward at the material world while purifying oneself from carnal passions. Wilmhurst contends exposure to lodge members and corresponding psychic atmosphere enhances higher consciousness, power over the physical mind, and a candidate is thus assisted in overcoming base desire. Before continuing to the next degree, the candidate must satisfy certain tests to demonstrate his victory over base desires. Cosmic Reality Rule Number 1. We are what we think. Second Craft Degree, Fellow Craft. The second craft degree is of Fellow Craft continues to stress the candidate must look inward. Wilmhurst states that deep psychological self-analysis is required and the individual is supposed to be at a level where he will begin tapping into psychic faculties of the soul to experience unusual phenomena. One would assume that phenomena is psychic in nature. 2 key words of this degree are contemplation and enlightenment. In the end, the candidate must realize God is within each individual and not some outside force. This conclusion is drawn by the candidate's study of man's psychical nature, eventually leading to a realization of one's own divinity and that the kingdom of heaven is within each individual. Thus, the goal of the second degree is to teach the secrets of nature and the principles of intellectual truth, which the candidate can only comprehend upon successful completion of the first degree, where he has unfettered his mind from mundane interests. Third degree, Master Mason. The third degree of Master Mason is integrally entwined with the story of Solomon's Temple, perhaps the best known myth surrounding Freemasonry. Yet the literal story really represents 2 spiritual truths, one involving an individual's relationship with his soul, the other a history of the human race's development. The legend involves the building of a temple in Jerusalem during Solomon's reign. The chief architect was Hiram Abiff, assassinated before the temple was completed, taking with him the secret of how to complete the temple. Symbolically, the temple was being mystically built using the souls of men, but because of a conspiracy, the construction has been delayed indefinitely. Thus, one has the fall of man. Conspiring craftsmen had assassinated Hiram Abiff in trying to obtain forbidden knowledge. Adam and Eve broke God's commandment to refrain from taking the fruit from the tree of knowledge. In both cases, the tree of knowledge and Hiram Abiff's are sources of enlightened wisdom. Universal knowledge has been denied mankind. We do not know how to find the tree of knowledge, and we cannot finish the mystical temple. Instead of enlightenment, mankind continued struggling in the limited environment of the five senses and intellectual gyrations of logic, science, and rationality. Essentially, we are blind. The blindness refers to humanity as a whole, and the candidate specifically. After realizing limitations of physical consciousness, the candidate must reject the sense-related physical conception of reality before completing his spiritual rebirth. This total rejection is considered a figurative death from one's physical or lower self. The spiritual death is symbolically represented by the skull and crossbones, long a Freemason symbol of the Master Mason. Freemason versus Nazi Brotherhood. Based upon what could be gleaned from available Masonic documents, I concluded the Mason is in search of a secret knowledge and ultimately power. Unfortunately, this reminded me of the Nazis. Hitler realized the inherent desire of a human being to consider oneself as important in the scheme of things. He also understood this human tendency could be exploited by bringing people into a brotherhood with access to secret knowledge, for knowledge is power. As in Freemasonry, the Nazi Party promised membership made individuals part of a special breed, having a divine purpose. While Masonry stresses the individual must evolve in order to obtain individual power, the Nazi made the party the critical element, with the individual gaining importance by simply being a dutiful member of the party. The fate of the Nazi Party was divinely inspired, and thus the individual's acceptance into the party set them above all others. The seeming difference between the Masonic and the Nazi emphasis on the individual may, unfortunately, be only philosophical. According to Wilmhurst, part of the Masonry's use of secrecy is to prevent the individual access to psychic powers, for it is possible certain individuals could obtain, quote, natural and supernatural states, unquote. At which vast powers exist, while being untuned to the divine and therefore capable of diverting the power to unholy, demonic, astral, and dangerous uses. With this stated fear, Wilmhurst has hit upon the inherent dangers of Freemason organization. Each lodge is only as pure as its members. Wilmhurst also stipulates most candidates are kept in the dark and acknowledges existence of interior circles. He further claims Freemasonry was created by an obscure and anonymous group as an elementary expression of the secret science. While I did not know if Hitler had access to a secret science, Ravenscroft's Spear of Destiny had discussed another similarity between Masons and Nazis. Ravenscroft had unveiled the identity of his Nazi inner group under Eckhart. It was also certain that, like Masonry, the vast majority of party adherents had no knowledge of this inner circle nor the philosophy at its roots. The question was now one of identifying the philosophy and identity of the group at Freemason's core. The core group. The only clues available concerning the identity of this group was they were concerned with protecting a secret science rooted in ancient knowledge, having certain basic truths. Wilmhurst claims these truths are central to all great world religions, and there has really been only one world religion. That religion would seem entwined with Christianity. While there are a variety of Masonic orders, all have the common ingredient of being with the three craft degrees discussed earlier. While there are a variety of Masonic orders, all have the common ingredient of beginning with the three crafts degrees discussed earlier. According to Wilmhurst, the three craft degrees correspond to the three ceremonial degrees incorporated within the doctrine of the earliest Christian groups, as well as representing the 3 years of Christ's ministry ending in death and resurrection. Masonic tradition also incorporates the concept of spiritual death and rebirth within the third of the craft degrees. Thus, it is obvious something of Christianity has been incorporated within Masonic doctrine. However, after 1717, Christian churches were relegated to a position in par with the synagogue, that is, simply a source of opinions. Thus, it appeared that while Masonry accepted Christianity, the Vatican and other churches were not considered custodians of ancient mysteries. During the 2 years I studied Freemasonry from an academic standpoint, I also began asking others what they knew about Masonry. In most cases, there was a relative or friend who had been a Mason. In all cases, nothing of importance was known about the organization. One friend's father had been a Mason and exhibited fear concerning the organization, yet even he would tell nothing about Masonry. It seemed Masonry was everywhere while remaining an unknown entity. It was obvious the secret death oath taken by Masons was taken seriously. No one, even those who had left the order, ever related Masonic secrets. It was also evident Masonry was worldwide and members could be found in all areas of society and economy. I began to seriously wonder if there was a Freemason connection to the Kennedy assassination. After all, the complex assassination scenario depicted by Lifton's best evidence implicates numerous, apparently diverse individuals in the planning, execution, and cover-up of the Kennedy killing. In light of Masonry's apparent power over its members, it would not be surprising to find Masonry as the common denominator in the individuals directly implicated in Kennedy's assassination. It is possible those who planned the assassination exploited the Masonic oath of allegiance, and the only real crime committed by the many men instrumental in the various aspects of the murder and ensuing cover-ups was to unquestioningly follow the directions of senior Masons. Because of the apparent benevolent doctrine and positive influence of Masonry in light of the Nazi connection to Oswald through De Moore Hengst, I think his name was George, in light of the evolution of Nazism, in light of the millions of missing Nazis, it was assumed that while the one possible link between various participants in the Kennedy killing and the ensuing cover-ups had to be Masonry, a Nazi shadow group had infiltrated the ranks of Masons and exploited the Masonic oath and loyalty to the Brotherhood. A Mason in the House. Meanwhile, during the weekend meetings of the Army Reserve Unit, I would sit down with a friend to discuss my newest discoveries concerning Masonry. This friend was an Army major and a vice president in a major airline company. I had found his comfort and discussions of psychic powers and secret societies to be surprising. had found his comfort with discussions of psychic powers and secret societies to be surprising. And while he never added anything to what I would say, he was very interested and supportive. 2 years into our academic relationship, I looked down to see he was wearing a Masonic ring. In total shock, I said, "You are a Mason?" "Yes, I thought you knew." No, I had not known that, but things became very clear. He had not added anything to the discussion because he was under a death oath not to relate Masonic secrets. Not only was he a Mason, he was a 32nd degree Master Mason, and you cannot get much higher in traditional Masonic ranks. So you didn't see his ring when you first started talking to him, or he wasn't wearing it when you first started talking to him? That's my question. Soon after this revelation, I asked him, "Is it possible a Nazi group could have infiltrated Masonic ranks to acquire new members, as well as provide them with a worldwide infrastructure, an organization within an organization?" The major was silent for many minutes. Finally, he looked up and very intently said, quietly, "Yes." It is not difficult to see a Nazi accommodate himself within Masonry. In fact, Hitler concluded that much of the symbolic nature of Freemasonry and its concept of a brotherhood could be used as the basis for creating a powerful organization. The Nazi concept of a blood brotherhood could have bound them to each other for life, regardless of Germany's demise. And it is possible a Nazi brotherhood survived the war in the form of those Nazis who had escaped Germany with billions of dollars in pillaged treasure. The worldwide Freemasons organization could have accommodated those missing Nazis, offering a means of communication with one another while providing a repository of potential new members of Nazi society. The existence of the Freemason organization adds another aspect to Cosmic Rule Number 6. You are not alone. Freemasonry permeates the very fiber of America, as does the more closed clubs represented by the Bohemian Grove. Secret societies have secret agendas and secret memberships. They are like sub-societies existing within the larger, ignorant society of the masses. Thus, accepted society is not alone, and no one can ever be sure that a member of a secret society is not lurking about. Just because you are paranoid does not mean they are not out to get you. Before continuing, let us define three words. Democracy means all for one. Communism means one for all. Fascism is all for the state. This may help in understanding the implications of the following discussion. Fascism is what Hitler's Nazi Party represented, but it was less the state and more the party for which all lived and died. That brings us to Chapter 5, The Vatican Connection. My birth in 1948 marked me as part of the post-World War II baby boom generation. My adolescence in the 50s had evolved into teenage life of the 60s, when all hell started breaking loose. It began in June 1963. Pope John XIII died. Within 5 months, President Kennedy was assassinated. I was 15. Those 5 months have dominated my life. Pope John the 23rd. What did I say before? I don't think I said 23rd. Pope John the 23rd was who we're talking about. XXIII. The assassination's impact upon individuals as well as nations can be readily rationalized by the effect the Pope's death had upon my life. Let me try that again. Pope John the 23rd The assassination's impact upon individuals as well as nations can be readily rationalized, but the effect the Pope's death had upon my life was harder to explain. John the 23rd was really the only Pope I had known, but I do not remember ever thinking much about him, other than in the context as his being leader to my church. It was death itself that was a new concept for me. Mom and Dad hid the deaths of pets, and no relatives or friends had ever died. And no one could really explain this death thing, but everyone seemed sad, and everywhere you looked, people were talking about the event. For some reason, the death of Pope John XXIII made a massive impact on my 15-year-old mind. I cut out and kept the local newspaper's accounting of these 3 days between the Pope's death and his burial. Somewhere down the line, Mom found this research and placed it with other childhood treasures she was keeping for me, unbeknown to me. Then, 15 years later, while the family was together for a wedding, Mom took out the various childhood treasures and gave each adult child his or her personal collection. I found those pages of newspaper folded up and stuck in the back of a teenager's photo album. When I realized their content, I clearly felt the hand of destiny leading me to some ultimate conclusion. For the previous year, I had been researching the life of John the 13th. No, the 23rd. And still had innumerable questions not answered. This 15-year-old newspaper treasure made a connection linking the Pope with the President and tied both to Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. This papal research did not simply evolve out of my investigation into John Kennedy's death. Remember the voice I heard in my head that caused me to read Glenn Wood's article on Freemasonry? And remember I said certain information was also transmitted? Well, part of that additional data was to look for a connection between Kennedy and Pope John the 23rd. Somehow the Pope's involvement with Kennedy was crucial to the puzzle that the voice in my head had presented. Angelo Roncalli, Pope John the 23rd. On October 9th, 1958, Eugenio Pacelli, better known as Pope Pius the 12th, died. 19 days later, his successor was named. Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli ascended the throne of St. Peter as John the 23rd. The new pope was 75 years old and destined to rule for 5 years. The announcement of Roncalli's selection was made on the evening of October 28, 1958. He was 75 when he was made the pope. 75! He should have been retired. No wonder these people don't know what they're doing. They're all old and senile. Sorry if I offended anyone. The next morning, Roncalli addressed the world in a 12-minute radio message. In understanding Angelo Roncalli, his 12 minutes became critical. The radio message was a forecast of those subjects, which were to become the new pope's greatest concern, the threat of war and the economic well-being of humanity. Pope John the 23rd reminded the rulers of all nations in whose hands are placed the fate, the prosperity, and hopes of the individual peoples that the people had not asked for. Those monstrous means of war discovered in our time, which can cause fraternal massacre and universal slaughter. According to the Pope, instead of nuclear weapons, the people had asked for, quote, peace and virtue, which the human family can live freely, flourish, and prosper, tranquility and concord from which alone can rise a true prosperity." Unquote. Roncalli was born into an environment that must have nurtured his understanding of what the poor face. The Roncalli family had lived for hundreds of years struggling as sharecroppers in the shadow of the Alps of northern Italy. Angelo was born in the stone house, which had been the Roncalli homestead for generations. As the oldest son of 12 children, Angelo escaped the lifestyle of his father by entering a seminary at the age of 11. The seminary was located in Bergamo, where he became a priest in 1904. Catholic Action. In Bergamo, Roncalli became involved with Catholic clergy, convinced the church had to be concerned with the physical environment of the people, as well as the spiritual well-being. There was a clear demand by those centered in Bergamo. The church had to develop a social conscience and fight for the rights of peasants and laborers. The various actions initiated by the clergy during this time frame came under the umbrella term Catholic Action. Thus, the future pope, with his peasant roots, matured in an environment where Catholic clergy felt a responsibility for their congregation's economic well-being. Throughout his life, Roncalli remained an ardent supporter of Catholic Action. In 1961, the Pope proclaimed, quote, "Probably the most difficult problem of the modern world concerns the relationship between political communities that are economically advanced and those in the process of development," unquote. To Roncalli, technical and financial aid had to be given by advanced nations. Quote, "In sincere political disinterestedness," unquote, to developing nations still in the throes of hunger and misery. In addition to admonishing advanced nations to care for less developed nations, Roncalli pointed out only employers had the means to prevent the recurrence of massive unemployment, and he urged them to restrict profits while assuring adequate wages. Apparently, the Pope felt an individual, whether politician, employer, or priest, had a responsibility to alleviate the problems of the people. Resume. Except for serving in World War I as a chaplain with the Italian Army's Medical Corps, Roncalli stayed in Bergamo until 1921, when he went to work on the Vatican's missionary program. 4 years later, Roncalli became a bishop assigned to the Vatican's diplomatic corps. His first diplomatic post left him in Bulgaria until 1934, when he became an apostolic delegate for Turkey and Greece. He remained headquartered in Turkey throughout World War II, which saw him actively assisting fleeing Jews and others escaping fascist Europe. In 1945, Roncalli took the post as nuncio to France, where he had to confront a war-torn nation, where Vichy Catholics had supported the Nazis. He remained in France until 1953, when Pius XII appointed him a cardinal and named him Patriarch of Venice. Roncalli's next post was that of Pope. The French Connection. In France, Roncalli had faced economic and social realities of post-war Europe. And again, Catholic clergy strove to align themselves with workers' needs against Vatican policy. The French workers tended to associate the Catholic Church with social order, the rich, and middle-class employers. Catholic clergy found themselves working in a nation where 80% of the population were Catholics, but only 1 in 4 regularly attended Mass. To offset this trend, priests began working and living among workers. This growing unity among Catholic clergy and workers resulted in the Vatican's 1949 decree that anyone collaborating with communists would be excommunicated. Communism. This anti-communist fervor exhibited by the post-war Vatican did not match Roncalli's style. During his tenure in France, Roncalli was outwardly friendly towards the Soviet ambassador to France. As Pope, he met with Khrushchev's daughter Rada and her husband Alexei Adzubi in the Vatican. Adzubi was not only Khrushchev's son-in-law, but he was also a member of the Supreme Soviet and editor of his nation's second most popular newspaper, Izvestia. And there's pictures in here, too, of people. This meeting between the Catholic Pope and a high-ranking Soviet official in early 1963 sent world speculating Pope John would act to bring Khrushchev and Kennedy together. Yet evidence indicates secretly such a union had already transpired. Even in November 1961, Khrushchev thought enough of the Pope to send his personal good wishes to Roncalli on his 80th birthday. Pope John promptly sent a thankful note ending, quote, "I will pray for the people of Russia," unquote. Cuban Missile Crisis. Perhaps it was those prayers that helped the world survive the Cuban Missile Crisis less than a year later. More likely, it was active participation of the Pope, the U.S. President, and the Soviet leader that tipped the scales, although prayers could not have hurt. With Norman Cousins, then editor of Saturday Review, acting as liaison, Kennedy and Khrushchev agreed a papal appeal for peace would help alleviate the hostile environment threatening to escalate into nuclear war. Through the night of October 25, 1962, in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Pope John XXIII wrote an address he and two other world leaders hoped would prevent war. That message can be summed up in his emotional plea. Quote, "Hear the anguished cry which rises to heaven from every corner of the earth, from innocent children to old men, from the people in the cities and villages. Peace, peace," unquote. And the world mass media, including that of the Soviets, took up the cry. The response was a marked easing of tension, allowing Khrushchev to announce his willingness to withdraw the missiles from Cuba 2 days later, and allowing Kennedy to praise the Soviet leader for his act of statesmanship. Three leaders. Norman Cousins continued acting as intermediary between three world leaders. He spoke to Khrushchev of Kennedy's ardent desire for a nuclear test ban, of the Pope's intent to establish tentative contacts with Soviets, and concerns for the religious liberty of the Soviet people. Khrushchev sent a personal message to the Pope through Cousins. The Soviet leader wished the Pope good health during the Christmas season, using unmistakable religious allusions. Cousins also carried to Khrushchev the papal medallion from the Pope, which the Soviet premier kept on his desk at all times. While Norman Cousins was identified as one intermediary between the three world leaders, there were others at many levels. There were technicians installing a communication system between the two nations that came to be called the hotline. Contacts were also made on social, economic, and cultural levels in a move to thaw relationships between the superpowers. The Pope, meanwhile, continued to push for world cooperation through his concept of united Christianity. Within 3 months of becoming Pope, John the 23rd was planning his ecumenical council, which he envisioned as a beginning stage toward unifying the Christian world. The Pope initiated Vatican Council No. 2, but the council was automatically terminated upon the Pope's death. Yet, while only in session from October 11th to December 8th, 1962, one well-known Catholic theologian, Father Hans Küng, believed the council had changed the atmosphere of the Catholic Church. To Father Küng and others, the council's evolving concept of a theology of union was far more important than promulgation of any formal changes. In its brief session, the Vatican Council indicated to almost a half a billion followers, the Church was actively working for reform and renewal. To non-Catholics, the image of a monolithic authoritarian Vatican bureaucracy began to crumble. One intimate advisor to the Pope, Cardinal Augustin Bay, went so far as to say, quote, both individuals and society should leave each one free to accept and to fulfill his obligations and duties exclusively by the use of his own free will, unquote. Cardinal Bay told an American audience the Church could accept the teaching that a man had the right to choose his own particular brand of religion, or even to reject religion. Through his Vatican Council, Pope John was paving the way for major reforms in the Catholic liturgy and ritual, while extending a Catholic hand to all Christians through active participation in concerns of the world's poor. Roncalli was moving down the road begun in Bergamo as Catholic action and forfeited in war-torn, impoverished French cities. Through his Peace on Earth encyclical issued just before Easter 1963, Pope John again pleaded for world disarmament, demonstrating his firm belief the Church had to be concerned with affairs of earth as well as those of heaven. Through his open-minded actions, the Pope was facilitating warming of relationships between the two superpowers. In January 1963, meeting with Khrushchev's son-in-law, Alexei Adzumbay, which sent the world wondering if something more would be forthcoming, was to be followed by a visit by President Kennedy about June 20th, 1963. But the Pope was dead on June 3rd, 1963, and 5 months later the President joined the Pope. There is, of course, the possibility the deaths of Kennedy and the Pope in the same time frame were simply coincidence. Then again, we know about the connection between coincidences and thoughts, Cosmic Rule Number 5. And it had to be Cosmic Rule Number 5 kicking in when I happened to see a television talk show with a guest named David A. Yollop. In God's Name. Yollop's book, In God's Name, relates his investigation into the murder of Pope John Paul I, predecessor of only a month to his successor John Paul II. Yollop provides substantial evidence indicating Pope John Paul I was murdered by members of the Italian Masonic Lodge known as P2. To understand the reason for the papal assassination, we must look again to the time just before and during World War II. Why are all of these popes named John Paul? Or they all have like the same name. Why can't they have their own names? Just another question. I've always wondered that. Mussolini signed a concordat making Roman Catholicism the only religion allowed in Italy and its territories. Adolf Hitler and his immediate associates were all Roman Catholics. In 1933, the Nazis signed a concordat with Cardinal Pacelli, Vatican Secretary of State, who became Pope Pius XII in 1939 through 1958, after the mysterious death of his predecessor. Also present at the 1933 Vatican Nazi signing was Vatican Prelate Montini, later Pope Paul VI, 1963 through 1978, successor to Pope John the 23rd, 1958 through 1963. And in Spain, where republics' presidents fought encroachment by the Vatican, Vatican-backed Freemason Franco became dictator and was recognized as such by the Vatican 20 months before the Spanish Civil War ended. There are accusations by such men as Charles R. Allen Jr., an expert on escaped war criminals. The book is Reformed Journal Judaism magazine. Oh, it's not a book, it's a magazine. Reformed Judaism. That the Vatican aided and abetted escaping Nazis, including the infamous Klaus Barbie. In 1942, the Vatican took an $80 million payment for the Vatican land purchased by Mussolini and put it into the hands of an association of trusted men made responsible for investigating these funds. This association became the Institute for Religious Work, and by 1971 it was headed by Archbishop Paul Marcinkus. The American Marcinkus involved the Vatican with Roberto Calvi, a major Italian banker who had taken a modest local Italian bank in 1940 vintage and evolved it into the largest private financial institution in Italy. Marcinkus and Calvi had an agreement which moved Italian funds to Switzerland, Nicaragua, Peru, Argentina, Panama, and the Bahamas. The Nassau Bank in the Bahamas listed Archbishop Marcinkus as a director. Calvi was also implicated as having dealings with Gilli, Grand Master of the Italian Freemasons Lodge, known as P2, considered a fascist organization. Grand Master Gilli was a critical contact for Calvi's South and Central American financial transactions. Gilli was so highly regarded, Argentina's President Perón was seen to kneel before Gilli. Gilli's P2 Masonic Lodge was illegal due to its activities in the 1970s, which saw 1,000 Italian leaders brought together to create a state within a state. This radical Masonic Lodge leveled dramatic penalties to renegade members, including tongues being torn out and throats cut. That's gross. Yet, in spite of its violence, these Masons believed a violent coup was not required to control the most important positions within Italy. P2 believed it could take over the country by placing its Masonic members in places of power. Calvi came into public attention after his June 18, 1982 death, originally listed as a suicide. However, evidence was uncovered supporting contention Calvi was murdered. Further investigations led to the connection between Calvi's bank, the Vatican, the P2, and the Mafia, whose money was probably being laundered through the Calvi-Vatican scheme. David Yalop's in God's name, takes the investigation even further, claiming there were over 100 members of the Freemasons within Vatican City and the P2 had formed links with priests, bishops, and cardinals. Yalop concluded Pope John Paul I was assassinated before he could destroy the P2's control of the Vatican and Vatican finances under Calvi's control. Assuming Yalop was correct, the possibility Masonic power had also been a reality in the days of John Kennedy and Pope John XXIII had to be considered. And that's it for today. The section we are going to be starting on next week is called The Mafia Connection. Okay, thank you for joining me. Thank you, Nancy, for producing this show. And I'm tired, so I'm going to bed. Hope y'all enjoyed it, and I will talk to you later. Bye.
You have been listening to Sassy Reads for You with Annette Bobko, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. Radio player and archives can be found at cosmicreality.com.